I was driving across the state of Kentucky several years ago, and it happened to be the first Saturday in May. That is Kentucky Derby Day. I didn't realize it until out on the interstate I began to see signs that talked about how many miles it was to Louisville and what was going to happen when you got there. It was like there was an air of festivity over that part of our country. And so I stopped in at Frankfort, and there at the State House and out in the grounds around it, it was just like a picture from a fantasy storybook, or like a part of a documentary film where they sweep the streets clean before they turn the cameras off. There were lovely ladies in white ankle-length dresses carrying pink parasols to shelter them from the midday sun. The sky was blue. There were billowy white clouds every once in a while in it just to set it off. And these ladies were walking beside gentlemen in white suits who were sipping mint juleps. It was just like it was supposed to be. I went on over to Louisville and got out to stretch my legs there, walking down Muhammad Ali Boulevard. And there was an air of excitement everywhere. I could hear little clusters of people here and there talking about how they got their tickets, when they got their tickets, when they ordered them, and so forth. One man offered me a ticket for $200, which was not a difficult decision for me. It was just like it was supposed to be. Am I doing something wrong? Oh! Sorry. I just got back from the city of smog. And they had a little device there that you could put in your pocket, and once you turned it on, which was easier said than done for some of us, you could just go anywhere. You didn't have to worry about it. You have to be back there first? Is that it? Why don't I just stand behind this one, huh? Okay. Double whammy. It was just like it was supposed to be, and I didn't go to the race, but you can imagine these horses. There's not a doubt in my mind that they can sense this air of excitement that's been building and building for several days. These horses have a relationship with the jockeys that are going to ride them, and the jockeys have become more and more excited about what's going to transpire. And as the moments count down, and the crowds are in the stands buzzing, and the horses begin to step up to the gates for this race that has this whole economy built around it, but which itself is only going to last for a couple of minutes, you know those horses are raring to run. They can hardly wait until the gates are open and they can shoot out of there. And when the start is given and they begin that, there's something that to me is the only thing out of place in this whole picture. As the jockeys are hunched down on these horses to do away with as much wind resistance as possible, and they come out of the starting gate, each one of those jockeys has something in his hand. What is it? A whip? Why a whip? When we have the finest jockeys in the world riding the best racehorses in the world. And you go to the Preakness a couple of weeks later and the Belmont Stakes a couple of weeks later, and it's the same thing. Why a whip? Don't the horses want to run? Don't they know what the situation is? Of course they do. Then why is the whip necessary? You know, if we were to go back to the days of the cowboys, there was a special relationship that developed there between a man and his horse, especially somebody who's out sleeping on the plains at night, and his horse is his only companionship. He might talk to that horse as they ride along, wake up in the middle of the night and talk to the horse. He takes his signals from the horse.
Maybe the horse sees a snake the man doesn't see. There develops a camaraderie between these two as they live their lives, month in and month out. Well, what are those protruding from the rear of the heels on that cowboy's boots? Spurs. Why spurs? Why is the whip necessary? Why is the spur necessary? You know, politically speaking, we have in legislatures nationally and also from state to state, we have what is called the party whip that you may or may not have heard of. But the party whip is appointed by a particular political party, and the job of the party whip is to enforce party discipline and to try to get the members of his party there in the legislative assembly for the important sessions. Now, these legislators are not children. There are a few Ted Kennedys that act like young drunk punks, but for the most part, I think Congress and our legislatures statewide get a bad rap. These are people who work hard, they are intelligent, they're motivated, they're organized, and they have offices that are organized. If they themselves don't know what to do, there are people in their office that keep them in line and tell them what to do. Why do they need a party whip in the legislature? We've got a lot of Canadian geese down where we live. Hundreds, if not thousands of them, fly over our house every year. And I know they're doing it because I hear this insistent, incessant honk, honk, honking all the time during the seasons of the year that they're around. Canadian goose is a beautiful creature. We have found that they fly from the Hudson Bay to the Midwest at 70 miles an hour, virtually nonstop. And the way they're able to do this is by flying in those famous Vs. You've got a strong leader at the front, and they fly back in the draft that leader's flapping wings are causing. So it's easier for the ones behind in the V, and every once in a while somebody from behind in the V comes out and takes that forward place, which is the most difficult position to fly. It's like a race car being kind of sucked in behind a lead car when it's right up next to it. This is the way they're able to do it. Fly 71% longer that way, according to what I read. And we think that this honking is simply the motivating cry of the stronger geese to try to help the weaker ones, the ones that might tend to lag, help them keep up their flapping. As a matter of fact, when one of them becomes ill or too weak to go on and has to drop out of the flight, a stronger one will drop out too and stay with the weaker one until it's well enough to fly again. Now, I've given examples from the animal world, from the world of animals and humans together, and from the human political world, that I think are all saying the same thing. And it's the thing being said in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, verse 24. Let us... Did you ever notice in the book of Hebrews, by the way, that Paul told these people that they should be ready for strong meat, but they're not ready for strong meat yet, so he doesn't give them much of that, but he gives them a whole lot of lettuce. Have you ever noticed that? Let us do this. Let us do that. Let us do the other thing. Now, the structure of these verses here is having, having, let us, let us, let us. Verse 19, having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest. Verse 21, having an high priest over the house of God. Verse 22, let us draw near. 23, let us hold fast. Verse 24, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Now, most of the provoking we do is probably in the other direction. So let's not be thrown by the use of the word provoke. It simply means to stimulate, to spur, to goad into action. To love, that's the interior motivation, and to good works, that's the exterior manifestation. Let us consider one another to provoke one another unto love and good work. Well, why should we have to do that? For the same reason that the jockey needs the whip, the cowboy needs the spur, the politician needs the party whip, and the geese need to honk. Well, ideally, we wouldn't need to provoke one another, but it's not an ideal world, and the Lord knew that. So we do need to provoke one another unto love and good works. This is a valuable lesson. The geese can go further, they can accomplish more when they fly in the family V. And we go further in the Lord's work together than we ever could alone. In helping others, we help ourselves. So I'd like for us, for a few moments, if we can, to consider one another as he says here. Consider one another. This is not easily or quickly done because you and I are as different as two snowflakes are from each other. They say there are no two snowflakes alike. That's probably true. There are certainly no two of us alike. And he says, consider one another, which means from one to another, to another, to another, to another. Consider each other. Know one another well. Think of your home congregation now, whether it's this one or someplace else. What are the people in your home congregation like? Think of them individually. One is creative. Another is very practical. One is submissive. Another is aggressive. One is intelligent. Another is rather dull. One is always curious and absorbed and attentive. Another is usually rather vacuous and bored. One is innovative. One is imitative. One is competitive. One is cooperative. One is a joiner. Another is a loner. What are your brethren like? One is pugnacious. One is timid. Let us consider one another means know your brethren. That's the first step. Know your brethren. They are not alike. Jude suggested different approaches to different people. Some save with compassion, making a difference. Others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. So you use compassion on somebody and fear on somebody else. Why? Because they're different. How do I know they're different? Because I know my brethren. In considering one another, that's the first thing I've got to do, is to get to know my brethren well. That's a process that consumes time, but I cannot consider you to provoke you unto love and good works without going through that process. We don't use the same approach with all God's children any more than a father in a family would use the same approach with all of his children. Assuming that we have gotten to know one another and we want to provoke unto love and good works, how do we go about doing that? I wrote down four things that I think are very significant here. One of these has to do with example. The example that I set, the example that you set. Now, this is obvious, and yet there's no way that I can deliver this lesson without stating it. The example we set is so important that I'm putting it as point number one. It won't make any difference what you say if you don't show the right example. If your example is not right, then while you stand there saying it, they're sitting there thinking, what you are speaks so loudly I can hardly hear what you say. Don't you do that with some of them? Sure you do. And so will they with you. You've heard the poem Edgar Guest wrote about seeing a sermon. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. Rather one would walk with me than merely show the way. The eye is a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but examples always clear, and the best of all the preachers are the men who live their creeds, for to see the good in action is what everybody needs. Example. I believe that we cannot adequately provoke one another to love and good works unless our example is somewhere close to right. I've already alluded to my point number two, and that is knowing one another. And I think the key to this is listening to our brethren. Listening to the things that they say publicly and privately, in edification and in just small talk. Whether we like it or not, we reveal something about ourselves every time we communicate verbally. And the astute brother or sister can pick up between the lines without having to assume too much, can learn what the brethren are really thinking of. Sometimes, in spite of ourselves, we say exactly what we mean, or we give it away with our words. Listen to your brother. This is a part of considering, to be able to provoke unto love and good works. You know, one time I went to visit a lady. She had been converted away from the Roman church a year or two before this. And at first she was very steadfast in her attendance of the assemblies and was a part of us, and then she began to withdraw and slip away, and finally she was hardly with us at all. I went over to see her. And I asked her about this. She said, "Nobody over there has any problems like I do. They all have their lives perfectly in order. Everything goes great for them. I'm the only one that has any dilemmas in life." I just couldn't believe I was hearing this. When I see my brethren, I see problems because they tell me about their problems, and we always are talking about those. So I'm always thinking about my brethren's problems. I couldn't believe that she meant this. But as we pursued this, I became convinced that she was telling me the truth as she saw it. She really, literally believed that she was the only one in the congregation with problems. It wasn't true, obviously, but she thought it was. What happened there? How did we make a miscommunication like that? I believe it's a problem that has to do with this particular area. We fall down somehow in this area of communication with each other, in the area of honesty, integrity, taking a risk on telling something to a brother or sister. Consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. Maybe one way I can help provoke you is by exposing enough of myself to let you know that everything in my life is not the way I'd like for it to be. That I face tremendous challenges every day. That I'm just an awfully lot like you, and that together the Lord knows we can work better than we could work apart. So I tried to set up that kind of a program for this lady so she could really get to know some of her brothers and sisters and be, to some degree, inundated in their problems for a while so she could feel better, or at least feel that people were more like her than they thought, than she had thought they were. Knowing each other, listening to each other. Example, knowing and listening to each other. Another thing is doing things together. How can we provoke one another unto love and good works? We can do things together. I know one man who says that none of us ever ought to do any good work by ourselves. I don't think I agree with that completely, but I understand what he means. He means that if I go to the hospital to visit somebody, I should take one of you with me. That if I go to a Bible study, I should take another one of you with me. That's what he means. I think to a degree there's some value in that type of thinking. When we do things together, we can enjoy it, sometimes where it would seem tedious to us if we did it alone, separated. Now, I talked about joiners and loners a while ago. I guess if I was going to personify myself, I would be in the loner crowd more than a joiner. I don't know why. I just always have been that way. And I'm that way now. I'm not a part of any organization, really, except the church. I just don't want it. I don't know why. Don't enjoy it. But can I push myself a little bit to allow you to be more involved with my life if you want to be? Would that help you to be provoked unto love and good works? Yeah, I think in some cases maybe it would. I think there's something to be said for that. Doing things together. Finally, we come to an area that we might tend to think of first when we talk about provoking each other to love and good works, but I'm putting it last because it may be the least important. And that's through the things we say to each other, the words that we use, publicly and privately. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. The goal of these words is not education itself leading to knowledge, but it's education leading to action, provoking unto love and good works. And there are some mammoth jobs that we need to do with one another. Mammoth not in the sense of being huge, but mammoth in their difficulty. When it's my turn to attempt to take the speck out of your eye, I have to be prepared for that.
If I'm going to properly provoke you, stir you, stimulate you unto love and good works, draw you back by getting that speck out of your eye, I have to be prepared. You know, a lot of people think, people in the church think, that Jesus told us not to try to get the specks out of each other's eye. Because that would be judging. Judge not that you be not judged. Have you ever heard anybody talk that way? When really, the very thing that Jesus is saying there, it's in Matthew 7, we don't have time to turn to it, is that you get the log out of your own eye so that you can get the speck out of your brother's eye. That's what the word then is doing in verse 5 of that chapter. Then you will see clearly to get the speck out of your brother's eye. Then you will see clearly. You'll be a better example, and you will see more clearly to provoke unto love and to good works. When it's my turn to try to take the speck out of your eye, I have a mammoth job. Intricate. I have to look for the right time to provoke you. I've got to look for the right wording, and I will even go so far as to write it down ahead of time. I'm not going to take it out and read it to you, but it may be in my shirt pocket while I'm talking to you, because I don't want to use words that are going to affect you in the wrong way. And if I know you, then I may know how to avoid those words. I've got to come to you at the right time, in the right place, with the right words, and that's not easy. That's why we consider one another. I've got to come to you in exactly the same spirit that I would want you to come to me. Not like I'm God's gift to straighten you out, but with the sense that I may be having the same problem this time next year, and I hope that you'll come to me in the same way I'm coming to you, because we're brothers. I want to provoke you, stir you, stimulate you unto love and to good works. And I want you to do that to me and for me. That's part of the lettuce that makes up the salad of the book of Hebrews. Let us do it. I think it's more often privately done than publicly. Publicly is such a blanket thing. We say the same thing to 100 people. And it's really hard to both comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable at the same time. It's really hard in the same lesson to do that. But when we get one-on-one, we can fine-tune the message, tailor it, and really do some stimulating, some probing, some provoking unto love and good works. I like the way it was put by the writer, once again, Paul, in the book of Ephesians, when he talked about speaking the truth in love. That is such a mouthful. Speaking the truth in love. Because I cannot go on knowing truth that you need to hear and always keep bottling it up, even though I might want to. Silence is not always golden. Sometimes it's yellow. And I've got to find the right words that will provoke you in the right way, if I possibly can. Maybe sometimes I come to you and tell you a story. What would you think of a guy that, and then I tell you this little story, like Nathan told David? Worked pretty well in that case, didn't it? David had his head in the noose before he knew there was a noose. And then Nathan goes, whoop, pulled it tight. Four words, you are the man. Did your brother ever come to you and tell you a story?
That might be an excellent way to use words to provoke to love and to good works. Speaking the truth in love. speaking the truth in love. This is such a difficult area, especially when we're dealing with sensitive issues in people's lives, and we so often are. I got a little piece of metal in my eye out in Tempe, Arizona one time. Bothered me and bothered me more until finally I went all the way across town, tear across Phoenix, to find a man who could take the tiniest tweezers made and pull that piece of steel out that was embedded in the cornea of my eye. It takes someone with skill to really know how to provoke unto love and to good works and to get that speck out of the eye. I didn't stop the first man on the street and say, "Hey, would you do this for me?" It's a sensitive area, which is exactly why ophthalmologists and others carry malpractice insurance, because it is so sensitive. Let us consider one another. Think about it long and hard. What to say to your brethren, how to behave with them, what to do with them to help promote the unity, the purity, the growth of the body of Christ. I saw them tearing a building down. A gang of men in my hometown, with a heave and a hoe and a hearty yell, they swung a beam and a sidewall fell. Then I asked the foreman, "Are these men skilled as the ones you'd use if you had to build?" He laughed and he said, "Oh, no, indeed. Commonest labor is all I need, for I can destroy in a day or two what it takes a builder 10 years to do." And I turned and I thought as I went my way, which of these roles am I willing to play? Am I the one who's tearing down as I carelessly make my way around? Or am I the one who's building with care so the church of the Lord will be better because I was there? Think about that whip, that spur, that goad. Can you be that? Can you use that? The Kentucky Derby jockeys don't beat the horses to death. They're just reminding them. They're just urging them on. They're encouraging them with the whip. That's what it's for. And even though, to me, with my idealism, it looks like it's wrong in the picture, when everything else was in a picture that was right, when we get realistic, it needs to be there. The spurs need to be in the flanks once in a while. All of us need those spurs in the flanks. I do, you do. That's why God gave us each other. Please don't resent your brother if they bungle an attempt to provoke you unto love and good works. Give them the benefit of the doubt. They're probably trying hard. Let's help one another as we consider one another. Help one another by cutting each other some slack in this area. And try to acknowledge the truth, especially when it's spoken in love, even blunderingly so. We all need it, even though occasionally we may deny it. This is a family we're talking about, and we need one another like the members of a family does. If you are not a part of this family, we would like for you to be, and so would the Lord. And there's a very simple process by which this occurs. You believe that the Lord Jesus Christ was who He claimed to be. You come to terms with that in your mind and begin to think of what this actually means, its ramifications throughout all of life. And because of what you believe, there's a change in your thinking that occurs called repentance. It's a reprogramming. When this occurs, you're sorry for what sin has meant in your life. You begin to see just the tip of the iceberg, the enormity of sin. And you change your mind about many things. And then on the basis of this changed mind and changed desires,
You come before the Lord and you tell Him in front of His people that you have changed your mind, that you believe He's who He claimed He was, and you want to walk with Him, that you finally found some reality in life. And then you allow someone in the family, anyone, to take you on the basis of this commitment that you're making and dip you in water for the remission of your sins. And you've been born into this family. That's all it takes. Much simpler than human gestation and delivery. It's one family that never gets too big. It's a family where we always enjoy the new infant so much that you'll probably be pampered and cuddled like any newborn baby would be. What a wonderful family it is. With all of its troubles, with all of the problems, what a wonderful family this is. And as you develop and grow in this family, you'll have all these brothers and sisters to help. And you will begin to learn to help them too. This is what God has done for us. Isn't He wonderful? He knew what we needed. Are you going to try to fly alone, or will you be a part of this V that is the way God planned it? The decision is yours today while we stand together and sing a song.